KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Wednesday, June 11, 1997, for broadcast at this time. Recording and broadcast are made possible by funds provided by the listeners of KIOS-FM. These programs are also broadcast statewide on the stations of the Nebraska Public Radio Network. Today's speaker will be Ron Hull, former general manager of Nebraska Public Television, currently special advisor to the Public Broadcasting Systems Program Fund, and president of the Mari Sandoz Heritage Society. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, the Omaha Public School District, or Nebraska Public Radio. Here now to introduce today's speaker is Bill Kelly of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Omaha Press Club Forum. I'm Bill Kelly, today's host for the forum and a member of the Press Club Board of Directors. Now in its third year, the forum provides leaders in government, the arts, community service, business and journalism a free platform to share their thoughts and opinions. We want to extend a special welcome to the listeners of KIOS-FM in Omaha. We're extremely pleased this afternoon to welcome to the Omaha Press Club, Mari Sandoz. Of course, Ms. Sandoz left us several years ago, but today we hope you'll leave with a sense of this remarkable Nebraska author. To that end, we welcome Ron Hull to our podium this afternoon. He is the president of the Mari Sandoz Heritage Society, an organization that assures the world will continue to hear this distinctive voice of the Great Plains. Shortly after Dr. Hull took a job with Nebraska Public Television, he first met Mari Sandoz back in 1956. That led to the filming, and it was filmed then, of 18 programs featuring interviews and readings of her work. They remain one of the crown jewels of Nebraska Public Television's fine history of programming. Dr. Hull also has a long history with both Nebraska ETV Network and Public Broadcasting Service nationally. As the director of the program fund with PBS, he played a key role in providing financing and moral support for some of American broadcasting's most notable achievements, including the American Experience series, Eyes on the Prize, a series documenting the civil rights movement, and The Power of Myth with Joseph Campbell. He was also instrumental at Nebraska Public Television in creating the award-winning weekly news program Statewide, an achievement which Nebraska and I will long be in his debt, since that's my job. But today we're here to talk about Mari Sandoz and the voice she gave to Nebraska and the Great Plains of America. We also, before we get started, want to welcome the two members or two people who will be the recipient of the Mari Sandoz Award, in the spirit of Mari Sandoz Award, Mary Fellman and Dr. Oliver Pollack. Would you please stand? They'll be receiving their award at the conclusion of today's program. So without further ado, the Press Club is very pleased to welcome to our podium Dr. Ron Hull.
I can't do this without glasses, sorry. Bill, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be in Omaha. Mari Sandoz would like the fact that we're here. We're sort of the anchor of the eastern part of the state, and we need to get more interest going for her work and what she has to tell us. Mari Sandoz wrote many books about very strong people. Women, protagonists, men, Native Americans, buffalo hunters, a full range of humanity. She called these people will-to-power individuals. That's a person who has to do it themselves. Someone who goes out and simply does it. And I think that this expression that she coined, a will-to-power individual, fits Mari Sandoz very aptly. Because to me, she was a will-to-power individual. You think about it. She grew up in a very unusual household, if you've read Old Jules. She only went through the eighth grade in high school. She taught school. Then a little later, she fell in love with, her sisters tell me, the handsomest man in the panhandle, a man named McCumber. They were married about 5 years. That didn't work. Mari was the breadwinner, and she had this inclination to write. And she wanted to write more than anything else. Her writing really, truly identifies her. She came to Lincoln. She was very fortunate to meet a very talented teacher. Teachers play such an important role for us. A man named Van den Bark. And with him, she literally taught herself how to write. And that's a major premise of Mari Sandoz's writing. And I want to share with you today her method of writing, some of her philosophy of writing, how she did it, what she shared with students she taught at the University of Wisconsin a number of summers. And I hope through these remarks that they will really inform you about the person Mari Sandoz. Her writing and herself are so indigenous of each other that that's what I hope to accomplish with you today. First off, Mari felt very, very strongly that anybody with the power of literacy could learn how to write well enough to publish. Now, she would be the first to tell you there's a big difference between writing for a country weekly newspaper someplace and writing for Harper's Magazine. But to her, all writing was important. She said that the great American novels often come from very unexpected places. So she always used herself as a catalyst to encourage people just like those of us in this room to take the courage and take the time and take the stamina to write your story. She would say, you have a great story to tell if you can bring the honesty to that story to make it worth other people's times. She always said, now, if you're a Thomas Wolfe or a Hemingway or a Faulkner, great intellectuals like that who have this stream of consciousness kind of writing, she said that's one thing. Those geniuses don't really know where their material comes from even. She said that's not the kind of writing I'm talking about. I'm talking about the kind of writing, the best writing in this country is done mostly by people who do, she said, my kind of writing because we're not geniuses. But we can learn to be very good, creative writers and even be artistic sometimes. But she said, that's the kind of writer that I am. I'm not a genius. I work very methodically. These geniuses have to have some fine editor like a Maxwell Perkins to come along and carve out of all that material the artistic work that we come to appreciate as Thomas Wolfe. But always remember, she said, in this process of writing, writing is not writing so much as it is rewriting and refining and repolishing and going back and rewriting again. I can tell you, well, I worked with her for over a period of years, but I remember one time she was asked to write a very small, maybe 500-word column for the Lincoln Journal. Was called I Remember Lincoln. It was at the time of the Lincoln Centennial. I personally saw 13 versions of that column that she had worked on and refined and repolished before it met her standard and was given to the editor of the Lincoln Journal. Mari also said it's very important to write out of your own experience. Now, what she means by that is that it's important to write about things that involve you personally at a deep emotional level, emotionally and personally. Your best writing, she says, will come out of that. She said, now don't worry when you're working on a book that somehow when you finish the book, you never ever have quite the emotional surge, a high moment that you had when you first thought of the idea for the book you wanted to write. I'm going to do the life of a 13-year-old Native American boy, for example. When you get that inspiration, your heart just sings. And she said, you never ever really come quite up to that level again in your writing. Because she says, you make compromises. We have to do that. Importantly, somewhere in the process, it doesn't matter because you've had another idea that you're going to work on as soon as this book is out of the way, or even concurrently. And that idea, that's the one that is really going to be the winner. And that is an important thing to remember about her, because I'll refer to it later, but that was an important part of the process of her working life. She had two or three books going all of the time, and it was directly related to the psychology of the strong emotional ties that you have when you're creating something as a writer. And I'll speak a little bit more about that later. Mari said 75% of men's first books are autobiographical. And she'd say that tells you something. 50% of women's books were psychological studies. Now, many of you think that Old Jules was her first book. It wasn't her first completed book at all. Her first book was what 50% of the women in the country write first, A Psychological Study. She said that she wrote this in the late 1929, 1930. She sent it off to a publisher. It was gone for months and months, and she finally got a letter back from the publisher, and he said, now is not a good time to bring a new author out. The economy is so bad right here in the Depression, but if times are better in 1931, we'll consider publishing your book. Well, in 1931, times were worse, and they sent the book back. And she said that distance that she had for 8 or 9 months away from the book gave her an objectivity. She said, I opened up this package, I started rereading that manuscript, and I looked at it, and all I could say was, oh, my. And she said, this was the bride's first biscuits that never poisoned the groom. And that was her first book. And then what she did with that was take it out and burn it. Never saw the light of day. She said to recognize from the very beginning when you write that you must understand conflict. Now, we all know that there is, in plays or theater or movies or television or great writing, there's no story there if you don't understand human conflict. And you must find that conflict, and you must deal with it throughout. You can't get people like us to walk in somebody else's shoes unless you're willing to deal with the conflicts that make that story vital and interesting to us. She says that the idea of conflict, we have different opinions about that ourselves personally. And she would cite the examples of underprivileged children, or at least children living in deprived homes. She considered that she grew up in a deprived home, a home that had a lot of dissension, a community that had a lot of dissension up around the Niobrara where they lived, those towns in northwest Nebraska. At that time, there were hired killers on the loose. But if it wasn't people, it was the elements, the blizzards and the bad crops and the bad luck and living in a dugout and all those things. And she said if you come out of that kind of an experience, then the kind of conflict that interests you is, in her opinion, is a conflict about social issues and fairness, and people having more of a sense of equality. People who come from privileged backgrounds, she said, didn't understand that. They were raised in a household where their ideas were important, where they were important as people, and they tend to be much more introspective, and the conflicts that interest them are the social class conflicts or the conflict between mother and daughters and between fathers and sons. But she said, always, always keep in mind that you're going to be dealing with conflict, or you'll only end up with a narrative. You will not end up with a good piece of nonfiction or a good novel. It won't be there. Now, some of you are saying, yes, but it takes talent to be a good writer. Mari Sandoz, and I want to say why I call her Mari. Everybody knows that in the western part of the country, even her own sisters, her own family who are living out there, they call her Marie. She was named Marie Sandoz when she was born. But when she became a writer, she dropped the E, and she preferred to be called Mari. And so that's why I feel we should call her Mari. That's what she wanted. But she said, talent is a dime a dozen. She said, I can show you so many people who've never done anything with their talent. You can have talent, that's fine, but you better have stamina. You'd better have an understanding of the kind and level of work that is required to achieve something that's worth other people's time. If you don't have that understanding, you're not going to be able to see it through. Now, she said, if you have that kind of stamina that I mean, and the honesty you bring to your own work, and the just simply giving it the time and effort that it demands, you may become a very fine craftsman, and she said, you may even become an artist. At any rate, that's how she felt. She always began with what she called a theme statement. Remember I said she was very methodical. So when she would think of an idea of what the premise of the book was going to be, then she would summarize in a theme statement the protagonist, the location, the conflict, what was going to happen, what is the point, what do I hope to achieve in writing this book, and what do I want the reader to know or to have when the book is finished. That's the theme statement. She said, I always start there. She said, now, a lot of people can't do that. It's so methodical. It paralyzes their hand. Then she'd say, I'd say, okay, sit down, write. Do it your own way. She said, the methodical person like me, or the stream of consciousness person you may be, more similar to a Thomas Wolfe, you're going to create a whole lot of material, piles of it. And she said, both types of writers at some point have to sit down and go through that material, and just as a sculptor carves out a statue, you've got to get in that material and find that work that you're working on. And she said, it's tough and it's laborious, but that's fine. Do it your own way. She said, I'm only telling you that if you follow my way, it's a step-by-step process, and it's how she's able to deal with the material. She said it's useful to a writer to write about one geographical area because all the research that you do always applies to anything that you write. She even mentioned one time, she said, I don't see how James Michener does it, because, you know, he'll write about Israel, and then he'll write about Spain, and then he'll write about Hawaii. And she said that's totally impressed her. She said, of course, he had 100 people to do research for him, too, which was something that she didn't have, and I might point that out. And I might also say, too, that nothing gave her more pleasure than to have one of her books succeed. And by succeed, I mean to have her make some money from one of her books. She loved that about her. I visit her many times in her apartment in the West Village, 422 Hudson Street was the apartment. Very frugal. Life, very modest circumstances. The one area of her life that she spent a little money or indulged herself. And the reason I know is because I hung up her coat a lot where she was giving speeches and things, and I could see the labels in her coats. She bought her coats at iMagnon and other places. She spent money on clothes because she felt she had to look good when she gave her speeches and things. But if you stay with that one locale, and you develop all this material. She left us hundreds of thousands of, I think 400, isn't it, Barbara? 400,000 cards, at least 400,000 cards of her research, all cross-referenced so that she could always go right to it and prove her point. Time Magazine, I don't know if you know this, but Time Magazine had her on a retainer for years and years. Whenever they published something about the Plains Indians, they'd run it past Mari Sandoz for accuracy. And that's what she said. She said, I'm not the genius. I want to be a respected, significant research person combined with a creative writing skill that I've developed. And that was really her goal. One thing that interested me, too, I've always been interested in theater and drama and used to act in younger days. And she was an observer, of her immediate surroundings and vicinity all the time. She was like an actor in that respect. If she were here today, she'd look around the room and she'd see a tie that a man has on, or somebody has mismatched socks, or some lady's hat. I don't see any hats. But she kept little scraps of paper and she'd write down things that just caught her eye. She would also write down sounds, vernacular, dialect, just pieces of authenticity on the subway, on the streets, in Lincoln, in Omaha. And when she'd get back to her apartment, and I saw this, she had one of those big old shopping bags we used to have, and it was hung on a closet door just by one handle. And when she'd get in, from a day. She'd empty this big bag she had of all these scraps of paper, and they would all flutter down in the thing. And then when she'd write, she'd be sitting in there, she'd have that bag by her, and she'd be making up a character or creating a character, and she'd reach in her bag, and then she'd remember that green hat with the pink feather, and she would write it down, and she always felt that she got in touch with a reality in her writing by doing that. It was one of the tricks of the trade that she liked to do. As I said, write out of your own experience, and then she would usually laugh a little bit, and she'd say, oh, that's really easy, isn't it? She said, you have to modify experience. Nature, after all, is not artistic. I teach a class at the University in Lincoln in international broadcasting, but one of the class sessions we spend on is what is art? What is the definition of art? And to me, Mari's definition comes as close as any definition that I have seen recently. Art, well, first I want to say this. Nature doesn't have to be artistic. Your business is to improve on nature, make it artistic. Art, it's over here, excuse me, is always in the commonplace. And I think we all know that. Art is vulgar. Vulgar is not a bad word. Art comes out of us, humanity, the people. Because it is in the commonplace, you have to only use words that mean the same thing to all of us. Now, to achieve this, you must take common words, raise these words to something specific in your writing, give it something extra, always. It is in the field of making common words carry the same meaning to all of us that we get the special meaning the writer has. Use common, simple words in powerful ways. And she said, if you are able to do that, then, she said, you are on your way to being an artist in terms of your writing. If there's one word you carry away, I hope you remember what a hard worker she was. She earned everything the hard way, in a sense. And I'll give you an example that she gave. I remember I told you that she said no book ever comes up to that first flush of excitement when your emotions are up there. I'm going to do a book on Crazy Horse. And then you work your head off for 3 years and you travel all over the country. And she said when she wrote Crazy Horse, I personally believe that at a very deep and a very wonderful level, Mari Sandoz fell in love with Crazy Horse. He was such a tactician. He was so intelligent. He had such a humanity that she so respected. If you've read Crazy Horse, you know what I mean. If you've ever seen an unpublished manuscript, a good book, a 500, 600-page book, not that that means good, but a big book, it will stand that high off the floor, 3 feet maybe off the floor of just the typed double-spaced manuscript. When she finished Crazy Horse, she had that manuscript in her apartment in New York. She said, I started to read it again, before she sent it off, and I read it, and she said, my heart sank because I realized I was telling this Native American story, this Native American history, but it was all being told in white man's words, white man's ways. And she said, it wasn't good enough. And she said, I didn't know what to do about that. And then she said, sitting here in my apartment in New York, I closed my eyes and I thought back. And she says, sometimes sounds from the past can put us back in the past as surely as any other thing that triggers our imaginations. And she said, I thought back to my childhood, my girlhood back on the Niobrara. And she said, I remember in the summertime when the Indians used to bring the ponies up over this ridge behind their house and take them down to the river. And I remembered the sound of the hoofs of the little Indian ponies as they went along through the sand hills. And it sounded like this. It was a thrump, 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 thrump. Very rhythmical, a cadence that just uplifted at the end. She said, I looked at that pile of manuscript and said to myself, I have to start over. And she started over, and she rewrote the book, but she built in to her paragraphs and her sentences this cadence that to her triggered in her imagination the sound of those hoofs. She said, I don't know if it works for you, but it works for me. And she said, that book comes the closest to what I set out initially. That comes up there the closest. But she said, remember, you never get a perfect book. She said one time she was giving a speech in Denver, and she had said that, and a large buxom farm lady came up to her, and she said, oh, Miss Sandoz, I know just exactly what you mean. My husband and I had 18 children before we gave up having a perfect one. Mari said, see, that's what I mean. The last point I want to mention about her writing method is get a whole lot of paper and write it first in longhand. She didn't even finish her sentences when she got going. She knew how she'd finish the sentence. She had to get her ideas down. She said, all the time you're doing this, remember your thematic statement that's got your protagonist, got your conflict, got your locale. Do that, but rip through that as fast as you can, because she said, you're going to rewrite this 18 times anyway. Get it down. She's always said, that gives me the rhythm, it gives me the flow, it gives me the energy. It worked for her. And I want to say one thing, and I cut a piece out of the Washington Post this week which confirms this point, and you'll just have to take my word for that. I couldn't find it this morning when I looked for it. But be sensitive that this is a very emotional process. When you send a book off, it's like cutting your arm off. She had writer friends that would work on wonderful books and never send them in because they couldn't bear to give them up. With somebody else to get it, some editor to get in there and mess around with that writing, couldn't stand it. Be smart. She used this example, and this has been documented in a later book. A young man came to her, as they did. I've carried back to her apartment poetry, manuscripts. We used to go to a place called the Blue Moon. It's right around the corner off Hudson Street there in the village. It's still there, still operating. But students from NYU and places would come over, and they knew Mari Sandoz, and they'd say, would you read this? Would you critique this? Would you make notations in this? And she took piles of stuff back to her apartment. She always did that for kids. She got this manuscript from this young man. This is 1948. She said, I read this. The manuscript wasn't finished, about 10 chapters. She said, it was absolutely wonderful. She said, I know this is going to succeed. She said, I got a hold of him, and I said, now, don't finish this. You start on your second book. You get lost in this new set of characters. She said, give me this. I can finish this for you. I know just what you're going to do. I know where it's going. Anybody who's read this, this is easy. Lose yourself in your next project. He didn't do that. The book was Book of the Month Club. It sold to MGM Movies. We're talking 1948. He made $250,000 the first 6 months. Then when everybody lionized him, and this is a great young new American writer, what is his second work going to be? And he'd put a piece of paper in the typewriter, and he'd type, and he'd get three sentences, and he would look at it, and he would say, that's No Rain Tree County, and he'd pull it out and throw it away. It was Ross Lockridge. He wrote one very fine book, went out to the garage, turned the key on, and asphyxiated himself because he couldn't get over the block, and he felt he couldn't live up to the expectations that others had, and that's a terrible burden for anyone to carry. So it's serious business. In conclusion, she always had time for everyone, and I have to tell you, I always felt very grateful that I had the opportunity to be in a television studio with her. She told me one time she would rather face a rattlesnake than my camera. You know, clumsy old camera. But I find it such a privilege. I think that Bill Kelly and John Flower is here, and other broadcasters. We've been so lucky, those of us who work in broadcasting, because anybody like Barbara Rippey sitting here, or so many people that are here that have so much to say. I believe that when you work in broadcasting, anybody that has something to say comes across your threshold. They often distill a lifetime of art and experience in a half hour or in an hour. And I just feel so blessed by that. And Mari Sandoz was one of those people. We did our work at the State Historical Society, which most of you probably know where it is. And then the old Temple Building was where we taped her programs. And I still remember the evening we were coming back from the State Historical Society. We were standing in front of Love Library. And I just turned to the library and I said, Mari, just think of it. You've got 19 books in that building. I mean, I think that's wonderful. And she looked at the building and she said, well, that's right. She said, my books are my children. That's it. And we walked across the street. When you think of Old Jewels and Cheyenne Autumn and Capital City and Crazy Horse, I don't know what your favorites are, but they go on and on. She left us really a wonderful family of legacy. That's how I remember Mari Sandoz. Jim Denny, thank you so much for arranging this today. I've enjoyed seeing all of you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Our speaker this afternoon is Dr. Ron Hull, president of the Mari Sandoz Heritage Society. He's now going to answer some questions submitted to the podium by our luncheon guests. I'm going to ask Mr. Jim Denny to maybe do a once around the room and see if there are any other questions. We have a number already. First of all, has there ever been talk of making a film of Old Jewels or other Sandoz work?
There has been, since the beginning, a lot of talk about making that into a film. As recently as 5 years ago, a producer in England, a woman who's done some very fine films for the BBC, contacted me to see if I could go to the family and see if we could get the rights. The woman was willing to put up $50,000 as earnest money, and we were not successful in dealing with the her agent in New York. They take a very, very conservative attitude, and we weren't able to do that, and it has never been done. It will be in the public domain, though, before too long, and someone, you may be sure, will do it. I just hope that we can steer it to someone who will appreciate the material. It is the definitive homestead book of our country, I think.
Very interesting question. Regarding Marie's tombstone, I wonder who the blank side is for, as she is not married since her divorce.
I can't answer that because I don't remember that. Barbara, do you remember the tombstone? I don't think there's a blank space on there for Mari. Is there? Who asked the question? Is there a blank for somebody else? That's interesting. I'll tell you something about this that interested me. Caroline told me this. Mari wanted to be buried at the top of the butte here overlooking the valley of the old Jules place. But she died in February or March. It was in the winter. The ground was hard. They could only get the hearse and everything halfway up the hill, and everybody said, this will have to do. And that's why she's where she is.
Describe the photo.
Well, now, the photograph is a beautiful marble monument. It's probably 4 feet, maybe 6 feet base with a four-foot tombstone on it, and it says Mari Sandoz, 1896-1966. But I don't understand about what you mean about it's just blank. Right. Well, you could put another person on there, but she had been divorced since the very early 1930s, and so I don't know. We'll have to ask the stone carver. I don't know.
Do you have a favorite Mari Sandoz story or book?
Book? Oh, one of her stories? Yes. I love Winter Thunder. I think it's a good book to start people on with Sandoz. It tells a good story. It's very crisp. She hasn't wasted a word in that book. Of course, I loved Old Jewels. I guess Crazy Horse is my favorite, though. Crazy Horse put me in touch with that country and those people better than any book I've read.
Willa Cather gets all the ink when people write about Nebraska authors. It's sometimes frustrating to have Sandoz overshadowed.
It is frustrating, but let me say, I'm also on the Willa Cather board, so you have to be careful. And John Neihardt, too, so I have loyalties for all. I would say this, Willa Cather, it offends me when people say she's one of America's great women writers. Willa Cather is one of the great writers America ever produced, and Willa Cather is there with Hemingway and Faulkner and Cather and a couple of others perhaps. Now, Mari Sandoz is wonderful. She is not in that same category of writing, and she would tell you that herself today because of the kind of writing she did. Cather was this great creative genius, and they come along very seldom. I would like to say this, though. I don't respect and I don't appreciate it when people say that Sandoz is a regional writer. And the reason I don't is because she wrote some wonderful stories and books. And I know people in France who love them and read them, and other Japan and places like that. I think if you've written a good story and it speaks to all of us as human beings in a universal way, you're not a regional writer. You're a writer that speaks to people wherever they are, and it doesn't have anything to do with geography. That's a diminution that I don't like at all.
A question of my own. A lot of authors are left moldering on the shelves, if you will. What's the society doing to make sure that Marie Sandoz's work remains in circulation and gets read?
Well, of course, that's one of our major premises, is to we encourage schools, we encourage teachers to teach. Brian Rocky has a program where we give schools copies of Sandoz books. We are just initiating this week right now on the campus at Chadron a young writers workshop, young writers workshop. Brian, anybody think of anything else we do? To perpetuate the work, to honor the work, and to keep it singing. That's the goal.
Who did Mari Sandoz admire as a writer?
She, like Neihardt, always said that she learned the most from reading the masters. Henry James was very important to her. He's the only name I can think of offhand that she has actually talked to me about. Barbara, do you? Exactly. Yeah, I do know that too. Thomas Hardy. Joseph Conrad, Barbara Rippey is helping me out here. Thank you.
Did Mari argue with her editors before the books were published?
If Mari wrote 19 major books, Mari had 22 editors. Mari argued with every editor she had. Now, I know from firsthand experience, a wonderful book. And here's one of my favorite Sandoz books. Hostiles and Friendlies, the collection of short works. It's edited by Virginia Faulkner. Virginia Faulkner, Mari Sandoz said to me, is the best editor in the United States. She said, I did not believe that somebody could take such disparate material and make a cohesive book the way Virginia has done. But Virginia, on the other hand, I knew very, very well. And Virginia almost lost her mind, you know, working, because Mari Sandoz did not want one comma. She, as I told you, she was a very methodical, thoughtful. She thought carefully about everything she put down. You change that, you know, at your own peril, and it's really a tug of war. I think this is true of all good writers. I know it was true between Mari and her editors.
It's also true with a lot of crummy writers, too, actually.
Probably is.
What impression do people who have never set foot in our state have once they've read Old Jules or other overworks?
Well, that speaks to me to the heart of why we have a Sandoz Society, why we honor the people we're going to honor today, that we find in our culture, we're very proud of our culture here and the high plains. Mari called it the high plains. I love that expression. To preserve what we have, to learn from these, from the wisdom of these people that precede us, and then to give that to our progeny, to our young people, into the future. That is what the march of humanity is all about, I think. And I think that if they read her work, they'll see that we are a tough people. We can overcome almost any hardship. We know what hard work is. We're a very honest people in the Midwest. We have great qualities, I think, which our country needs desperately today.
You mentioned in your remarks earlier about the column for the Lincoln Journal. Yeah. Do you have a recollection of what types of changes Marie made to that column in the Lincoln paper? What sorts of revisions she was making?
I can't answer that definitively. I don't remember well enough, except that, like everything, the first five she wrote were way too long. The paper was very clear on that. And, you know, it's much harder to write a 10-minute speech than it is a 30-minute speech. And it's true about writing, too. But I'm sorry, I don't remember it well enough about that.
Are there any new literary voices from Western Nebraska that we should be aware of, that you're aware of also?
I'm not sure. There's a very fine young man, a writer, that was in Omaha for a while, and he taught in Colorado. He was also a visiting professor at Nebraska Wesleyan. His name is not coming to me. He was a storyteller. He was a novelist. You think of that, Barbara? Well, not West. I don't know of anybody. Really? Jonas Agee. I don't know that name. I'm sorry. I wish I could think of this name. Central City. Who's our great writer from Central City? Wright Morris. He's alive, and he's still alive, and his works are very much worth your time.
Did Ms. Sandaz earn royalties to a degree that matched her talent? I guess that's a polite way of saying, did she get rich?
She didn't get rich, but some of her books did very, very well. One of her, Cattleman, for example, I remember she was so proud of that. Cattleman sold very, very well, and as I remember, something over $200,000 in sales. Now, she only gets a portion of that. But it'd be quite a lot even today, but you have to remember, she worked on the book for 3 years. She invested so much of her own capital in hotel rooms, in plane flights, and all the rest, that she didn't get rich. But she had the luxury from 1935, when she won the Atlantic Prize, until she died in 1966, of being respected, of having the privilege of doing the work she wanted to do more than anything else. The last time I saw her was at St. Luke's Hospital in New York. You know, she had bone cancer, very painful. And the last time I saw her, she was valiantly sitting up in bed. She had the, the come back from the publisher, the galley proofs. She had the galley proofs of her last book, and she was correcting them and writing notes to the editor. It was of the Custer book, which was her last published book. And I remember sitting there in the hospital room, and we were talking, and I only intended to stay about an hour. And she said, don't think about leaving. She said, my illness and the medicine, she said, food tastes like cardboard. I can't eat. And I have to finish this work. I have to have energy. You sit right where you are, and you talk me through lunch and get as much food in me as you can get in me. She said, you'll take my mind off of the food. And I did it for lunch, and I stayed through the afternoon, and I did it for dinner. Probably one of the best afternoons of my life. She ate that day.
To someone who has never heard of Sandaz, what would you say would be the most important things to remember about her?
I get back to how I began, that here was a woman with none of the privileges, who helped her mother raise those children, had no money, never had a pretty dress, never had a decent education, but had in her the spark of being something, of making something of herself, never having the courage to write her father's story until she got permission from old Jules when he said, "Mari, why don't you do my story?" You know, before that, he said to her, "You know, Mari, I consider writers the maggots of society." And, I mean, this is a big burden for anybody, a young woman, to carry. And then to go out and have enough courage in herself and just do it with integrity, I would hope that's how you would remember Mari Sandoz.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
You've been listening to the Omaha Press Club Forum, and our guest today, Dr. Ron Hull, Special Advisor to Public Broadcasting System Program Fund and President of the Marie Sandoz Heritage Society. Our next speaker is Fred Simon, President of Omaha Steaks. That will be at noon, July 9th. You're all welcome to attend. If you do not have to be a member of the Omaha Press Club to attend that event, and if you would like to join us for lunch, feel free to call the Omaha Press Club. We can also give you information about future speakers as well. We'd like to extend our special thanks to KIOS-FM and producer Bob Cote for providing the production and engineering assistance that make this broadcast possible. Thank you very much for joining us. We'd also like to welcome Dr. Hull and anyone else back to the microphone for a special awards presentation.
This is very easy. One of the things I hope you heard me say, and I hope that each of you, I see Cynthia back there. I know a lot of you people in Omaha do invest your time and your effort and your money in causes like this, but we have Nebraska is very unique. We have three literary heritage centers, the Sandoz Center, the Cather Center, and at Bancroft, the Neihardt Center. That's, to me, speaks volumes about those of us who call themselves Nebraskans. I don't know other states that have quite what we have there, but why do we do this work is what I said. Send along to the next generation, give them a chance, but give them the best of what came out of our generation. And that's why it gives me great pleasure. I want to introduce you to two people. We call this the In the Spirit of Mari Sandoz Award. And it's about people who give of themselves their time and their money to preserve heritage, to spark imaginations of the young, and to just contribute and make the state of Nebraska a community that we can all enjoy the best of everything in. And the two people I want you to meet are Dr. Oliver B. Pollack. He's the first person, and then I'm going to introduce you to Mary Fellman. But let me tell you something about Dr. Pollack and then Mary, and then I'll have them both come up and give them the presentation. Dr. Pollack, I think most of you know, is a professor of history at the University of Omaha. He's also a practicing attorney. He has written many, many articles, been published in the press, particularly about the Jewish community, historical items about the Jewish community. He's on the Nebraska Humanities Council Speakers Bureau. He's a community volunteer and somebody who's really made a difference, and I'll tell you how in just a minute. Now, Mrs. Fellman is out of that same mold. She is the editor of the Jewish Press, which is the weekly newspaper here in Omaha and Council Bluffs. She's been an advertising account executive in print, radio, television. She has a long history as a community volunteer. These people, as a result of their joint efforts, the Nebraska Jewish Historical Society has grown up to be the largest Jewish historical society in the United States. They co-edit the annual journal, the 16-page annual newsletter. They have been instrumental in the creation of the Carl Fromm Archival Center. And because of these efforts, we now have the first permanent Jewish museum in Nebraska housed at the Gordman Center for Jewish Learning. So they have really done their part, and it's exactly the kind of thing that we hope the Mari Sandoz Heritage Society and the others will do for our heritage, for our culture, and for the well-being of the people that follow us. So if Dr. Pollack, Mary Fellman, if you'd come up here, please. Now, this is your better than your average plaque, I think. But it says, the Mari Sandoz Heritage Society hereby awards Mary Fellman the In the Spirit of Mari Sandoz Award. It's signed by Ron Hall and Don Green. He is the chairman of the Humanities Department at Chadron State College, and he is the chairperson of our board. And there is a rendering of Mari Sandoz herself. I do hope when you leave here, from now on, she is Mari Sandoz. Okay? Is that a deal? Mary, thank you so much for your good efforts. You. If you would like to say something, we'd love it.
First of all, I'm very tempted to change my name, and it's going to be Mari Fellman.
Oh, good.
Because if she can do it, I suppose I could do it too.
You certainly can.
Okay. Number one. Number two, I have to tell you that this has just been a wonderful experience sitting here and learning from you. I haven't had a professor or a teacher of journalism or that type of subject for many years who reminded me of my first teacher, who was Annie Lane Savage at Central High School. I don't know how many of you had Annie Lane Savage, but she was superb. She was superb. She would stand in front of the class like this and talk, and everybody would love her. And she's the one who got me into journalism originally. This has been a wonderful learning experience for me, and I thank you very, very much for this honor. It causes me to want to delve more into the lives of all of these writers. I have a niece in Israel who teaches in one of the high schools who teaches about Mari Sandoz, and I think that her works and her fame is well known all over the world, and I think that what you do and what the others are doing is outstanding work, and I wish you strength and well-being in doing it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mary mentioned books, and I want to mention books. Brian has some paperback copies of Sandoz books in the back of the room. We always sell books. If that's one of the ways of our outreach, you know. The point is, you're supposed to read the books. I also want to mention that our weekend is coming up this weekend, and if you can't do it this year, I hope you'll think about coming to that beautiful Western country out there and being with us Friday night, Saturday night, and when we study a book, usually Dr. James C. Olson is our speaker this year, and he's one of the best scholars we've ever had. So you might keep that in mind and spread the word. Now I want to honor Dr. Pollack in the same manner. It's the same thing, but Dr. Pollack, we're really proud to give this to you, and we're really proud to be associated with people who give so much to the state and the community. Thank you. We want to hear from you.
You bet. It was absolutely thrilling to hear the rendition of Mari Sandoz as a writer. It was a sterling platinum gold card job you did. And it's nice to see we go through these transmogrifications of names from Mari to Marie, and you want to be renamed. But I want to tell you, with a name like Pollack or Pollack, half the time my name is spelt wrong, and I've gotten used to this, and I have 10 essays that I haven't published, and one of them is called What's in a Name? I've got 3 rejections on it, by the way. Okay. In 1981, I got an award from the Regents of the University of Nebraska for Oliver Pollack spelt wrong, and I never sent it back to them because I like the thoughtfulness of the Regents spelling my name wrong when they give me an award. It's spelt wrong. But I treasure it, nonetheless.
It's a good thing.
Oh, I think that's funny.
Yeah. Well, how do you spell Pollack?
You spell Pollack. I've done.
Is that an O?
You can check 15 cities phone books, and there's a regionalism and a protagonist and a conflict on how you, and a locale. on how you spell it.
Okay.
But it's okay, because I enjoy it, and it's you create the art out of the commonplace. My wife and I just came back from 2 weeks in Tuscany, and we found out what innate beauty is. It's just beautiful. And the Pope said last week he had to go to Poland because his son was too brilliant in Italy. In Nebraska, the beauty of the place is not innate. It needs to be thought about. It needs to be pushed around. It needs articulate people like Mari Sandoz and the rest of us who try to tease that beauty out of our not-so-Tuscan landscape. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll get that corrected. I will.
I want them both.
Well, I can say we're going to correct this, I promise. I have nothing more, except I do want to thank you both. Thanks so much for your efforts and for being here. Cynthia, do you have anything you want to say? Cynthia's on my board. Jim's on the board. Brian's on the board. I have some wonderful people. Barbara, anything else, Bill? Thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guest speaker has been Ron Hull, former general manager of Nebraska Public Television, currently special advisor to the Public Broadcasting Systems Program Fund, and president of the Mari Sandoz Heritage Society. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Wednesday, June 11, 1997, for broadcast at this time. Recording and broadcast are made possible by funds provided by the listeners of KIOS-FM. These programs are also broadcast statewide on the stations of the Nebraska Public Radio Network. Special thanks to Frank Scott, Omaha Press Club Executive Director, and to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next noontime forum at the Omaha Press Club will take place on Wednesday, July 9th at 12 noon. The guest speaker will be Fred Simon, president of Omaha Steaks International. If you would like to attend this or other Omaha Press Club noontime forum events, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to the public. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.